I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Renanine, and welcome to another episode of Cobb's Corner. If this is your first time listening, welcome, and to my returning listeners, welcome back. This is the 80th episode, so thank you for tuning in. On today's episode, we're going to continue our AFI Top 100 series with Some Like It Hot, from 1959. After two male musicians witness a mob hit, they flee the state in an all-female band disguised as women, but further complications set in. Storyline. After two Chicago musicians, Joe and Jerry, witnessed the St. Valentine's Day massacre, they want to get out of town and get away from the gangster responsible, Spats Colombo. They're desperate to get a gig out of town, but the only job they know of is in an all-girl band heading to Florida. They show up at the train station as Josephine and Daphne, the replacement saxophone and bass players. They certainly enjoy being around the girls, especially Sugar Cane Kowalski. I don't know if I'm mispronouncing that or not. Who sings and plays the ukulele. Joe in particular sets out to woo her, while Jerry slash Daphne is wooed by a millionaire, Osgood Fielding III. Mayhem ensues as the two men try to keep their true identities hidden, and Spats Colombo and his crew show up for a meeting with several other crime lords. The storyline provided to us via IMDb. The movie's directed by Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder, we've actually reviewed one of his movies before. He's known for his work on The Apartment, which came out in 1960. The Apartment is number 80 on the AFI Top 100, so we'll be talking about that movie in a future episode. He also directed Sabrina, 1954, and Sunset Boulevard, which was number 16 on the AFI Top 100. We talked about Sunset Boulevard on episode 76, so go back and listen to episode 76 if you have not done so already. The movie was written by Billy Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond. I.A.L. Diamond also worked on The Apartment, number 80 on the AFI Top 100. Stay tuned for that episode, as well as The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes in 1970 and The Fortune Cookie, 1966. The movie was also written by Robert Farron, known for films such as Singapore, 1947, The Fighting O'Flynn, 1949, and Hotel Imperial, 1939. The movie stars Marilyn Monroe as Sugar. Marilyn Monroe, I mean, how many of us haven't heard of Marilyn Monroe? She was in movies like Lorelei Lee in... Well, she played Lorelei Lee in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, 1953. She was the girl in The Seven-Year Itch, 1955. Many film scholars consider Some Like It Hot to be her last hoorah, like her last great performance before her unfortunate passing just a few years later. Tony Curtis, who I realize is actually the father of Jamie Lee Curtis. Tony Curtis, he plays the role of... Josephine slash Joe. And Tony Curtis, you've seen him act. He played Antoninus in the 1960 Spartacus movie, which is number 81 on the AFI Top 100, so stay tuned for our Spartacus episode. He played Sidney Falco in Sweet Smell of Success back in 1957. And he was Aunt Sophie Schwartz on the TV series The Persuaders, which aired from 1971 to 1972. Jack Lemmon, plays the role of Jerry, or Jerry slash Daphne. He's known for playing C.C. Baxter in The Apartment. He was also in The Apartment, which was, you know, directed by Billy Wilder. C.C. Baxter in The Apartment, so number 80 on the AFI Top 100. He was Shelley Levine in Glengarry Glen Ross, 1992, and John Gustafson in Grumpy Old Men, 1993. Let's go to Cops Corner. So the movie's set in 1929. It's set during the Prohibition era. I'm not sure if I've talked about Prohibition on this podcast before or not, but essentially, you know, for those of you maybe outside of the United States, or maybe for those of you who are unaware, at one point alcohol was illegal in the United States. It was illegal in the U.S. from maybe about 1920 to 1933. So during the Prohibition era, there were these illegal bars called speakeasies, which were these private bars where you had to know the password to get in. And so the movie opens up with a raid on a speakeasy. You know, well, we open up on, I guess there's a cop who is let into, who an undercover cop who makes his way into one of the speakeasies that's posing as a funeral home. And we're introduced to Joe and Jerry, our two main characters. Joe, played by Tony Curtis, and Jerry, played by Jack Lemmon, as I previously mentioned in the intro. Yes, Joe is played by Tony Curtis. You have Jerry, Jack Lemmon. And Joe is a saxophone player. I once played the alto sax once upon a time when I was in middle school, high school, and a bit of college. And Jerry is our bass player. You know, Jerry's a bass player. Joe is our saxophone player. And so they're playing with this band, and then all of a sudden the funeral home ends up getting raided by the police, and the two of them escape. And then the two of them escape from the raid, but then the next day they go to, I guess, their booking agency, the musicians, like the talent agency, and they're looking for a job after they've witnessed the raid. You know, they're looking for a job out of town, out of Chicago, out of the state of Illinois. And the only job that there is 3 weeks in Florida. I want to say Miami. I think three weeks in Miami, but it's an all-girls band, and they needed a bass player as well as a saxophonist. So the two of them, they agree to escape the mafia, or to escape the mob, essentially. They agree to do this job, but disguised as women. And in a later scene, they actually witness a fictional version of the real-life St. Valentine's Day massacre on St. Valentine's Day in 1929. That was actually in real life orchestrated by Al Capone and the mob. But in this movie, it is done by Spats Colombo. Spats Colombo, who's the mob boss who does the Valentine's Day Massacre, the fictionalized version of the Valentine's Day Massacre. So our two protagonists, they witness this massacre, and then they realize we have to get out of Dodge, and they dress up as women. And Joe takes on the persona of Daphne. No, Joe takes on the persona of Josephine, and Jerry takes on the persona of Daphne. And yeah, they get on, they board this train. They notice this other woman who's with who they later find out that her name is Sugar, and she's played by the late Marilyn Monroe. And they see her as she's walking onto the train, and they're just stunned by her beauty and you know, the way that she walks, and so I think that this movie does have like a bit of, I guess, satire for, like, you know, walking the proverbial mile in a woman's high heels, you know, both, I guess, literally and metaphorically, which we're going to see throughout the film. So they board the train, and you know, they board the train, and then there's all these, like, strict rules of, like, no boys allowed and that sort of thing. And then on the train ride, they actually, one of them actually has to go to the bathroom, and then they see how Sugar has is hiding this flask underneath her dress. Sugar, who plays the ukulele and sings, and she's hiding this flask underneath her dress. And then she even says later on how she's not very bright, and how she's always falling for these saxophonists who end up leaving her, and how another rule is that everyone in the band has to be under the age of 25, and how she'll be 25 next year, she'll age out of the band next year. And it's got her thinking about, like, you know, finding a husband and starting a family, and so. But yeah, you know, typical trope of, like, the dumb blonde who's, you know, not very bright, and, you know, is pretty much there for eye candy. Is pretty much just, dare I say, a sex symbol. So yeah, that's the kind of boundaries that this movie's pushing, and rightfully so. They make it to Florida, and as they're deboarding the train, they see, like, all of these, like, old, like, millionaires and billionaires just kind of sitting in their rocking chairs with their hats, like, and then as the girls are deboarding the train, or as they're, like, coming to the hotel that they're going to be staying at and playing at, it's like all these men, they all take off their hats, and they all just, like, give the girls a nod, and I mean, one of them is named Osgood Fielding III, who's played by Joe E. Brown. Osgood Fielding III, he says, like, hi, I'm Osgood Fielding III, and then I think it's Josephine who responds, I'm Cinderella II. the comedic timing in this movie is great. So I guess my next favorite part would be when Jerry decides to stay in his disguise and goes and plays beach volleyball with a few of the girls. They go for a swim, and then they're playing volleyball or whatever. But then Joe changes out of here. He says, I'm just gonna skip the beach this time. And he just ends up staying in his hotel room and changing out of his disguise. And turns out that he stole the music director's suitcase. Music director Little Bonaparte, played by Nehemiah Persoff. Bonaparte. Yeah, he steals Bonaparte's suitcase with all of his luggage, with all of his clothes. So then Joe ends up dressing up as, I guess, Junior, who's the heir to the, like, Shell Oil Company. You know, the heir to, like, the Shell Oil Company. So he's posing as this billionaire with, you know, who has a yacht in the harbor, or has, like, a ship in the harbor, and the ship that actually belongs to Osgood. And we actually see, like, Osgood actually kind of shoots his shot with Jerry, who, again, is in his disguise as Daphne. So there's a scene where Sugar, she finds Junior, and the two of them get to talking, and then he agrees to actually take her out, one night, and then so like the date is set, but then Daphne but then Daphne says like, we like, hurry, we have to run up to the hotel room to find Josephine. You have to run back to the hotel room. So, because again, Jerry, he knows that that's actually Joe dressed up as Junior, and that's not the actual, that's not the actual Junior, the heir to Shell Oil. So they run back to the hotel room, and sure enough, Joe beats him there, and he's in that same getup, in that same outfit, but he's in a bubble bath. So, yeah. And yeah, like we see like there's a lot of like back and forth between like Jerry and Joe about, you know, just tell yourself, you know, you have to kind of keep up appearances and save face. Keep telling yourself, I'm a girl, you know, you cannot, let's not forget why we're here, we're escaping the mob. And there's one night where I think Joe ends up going on a date with, or Jerry, dressed as Josephine, ends up going on a date with Osgood Fielding, and then Sugar ends up going on a date with Joe. Yep, ends up going on a date with Joe on the yacht. And then as they're like in the boat on their way to, and like the smaller like motorboat on their way to the larger ship that they have, it's like they can only really drive backwards. And so they get to, so Sugar and I guess Junior, they get to this boat, and Junior says how, Junior, who in this case is actually Joe disguised as Junior, he says how like he's never really been in love, and he's been incapable of falling in love. And I think this movie is sort of poking fun at, but acknowledging, like, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, impotence. And so yeah, you know, this movie was definitely, and I'm going to talk more about this in the next segment, this movie was really pushing the boundaries in Hollywood, and really, really sort of like pushing the boundaries of like what's allowed, what isn't allowed, and like censorship in Hollywood. And so yeah, we see a scene where Joe and Sugar end up kissing, and meanwhile, Jerry, dressed as Daphne, is on his date with Osgood Fielding, but then it all comes to a head when Osgood actually proposes to Jerry, and he accepts. So Jerry has now, like, pretty much owned up to his female persona. Like, this movie was really, like, progressive in that it was dealing with themes of transvestitism, impotence, you know, bisexuality, homosexuality as well, and you know, this movie was really pushing the boundaries. But then when they get back to the hotel room, Joe has to remind Jerry, he has to tell him that he's a boy. It's like, you're a boy, remember that. So over the course of the film, though, we do see that Joe is able to find, he's able to actually find Sugar attractive beyond just her looks, but actually her personality, and, you know, but actually her intellect and her personality and that sort of thing. So making her not just simply eye candy, but, you know. So there's a lot of like unlearning that these guys end up doing throughout the movie. And then it all comes to a head in the third act when Spats Columbo, along with his henchmen, and you know, and a few other gangsters. A few of the gangsters, they end up having a meeting in Miami at that same hotel that they're staying at. So it's like Joe and Jerry, they ended up leaving Chicago and coming to Miami. Leaving Chicago and going to Miami to escape the gangsters, to escape the mob. But then the mob now has now followed them to Miami. And then the movie ends with this really fun scene where there's like a banquet. And it's like one of the gangsters' birthdays. But then as they're bringing out the cake, it's like after the second time they sing, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow. After the second time, like probably one of the guys who worked at the hotel, like he just jumps out of the cake with like a, shotgun and then just like guns down, spats and all of his henchmen. So Joe and Jerry, they make a dash. No, Joe and Jerry, they make a dash along with Sugar and Osgood, and the movie ends with the four of them pretty much riding off into the sunset or riding over to the big ship to escape the mob. All four of them, Jack or Joe, I keep saying Jack. Joe finally takes off his disguise and says how he's not a millionaire, he's a phony. And he said, I'm just a no good saxophone player, just like the ones that you always end up falling for and end up leaving you. To which Sugar says, you know, I don't care, I love you. And so the two of them, they finally end up together. And then as Jerry is finally taking off his disguise, I'm gonna find the exact quote. last lines of the film. All right. Jerry, as he's taking off his disguise, Jerry says, "Oh no, you don't, Osgood. I'm gonna level with you. We can't get married at all." Osgood, "Why not?" Jerry, "Well, in the first place, I'm not a natural blonde." Osgood, "Doesn't matter." Jerry, "I smoke. I smoke all the time." Osgood, "I don't care." Jerry, "Well, I have a terrible past. For 3 years now, I've been living with a saxophone player." Osgood, "I forgive you." Jerry, tragically, "I can never have children." Osgood, "We can adopt some." Jerry, "But you don't understand, Osgood." Oh, Jerry finally gives up and pulls off his wig. It's like, "But you don't understand, Osgood. Oh, I'm a man." And then, very last line of the movie, Osgood shrugs his shoulders. "Well, nobody's perfect." So yeah, that's pretty much how the movie ends. And that's Some Like It Hot. So as I said before in the last segment, that this movie was definitely pushing the boundaries of Hollywood. Specifically, it was pushing the boundaries and defying the Hays Code. Now, the Hays Code, for those who don't know, the Hays Code, or the Motion Picture Production Code, was a set of industry guidelines for the self-censorship of content that was applied to most motion picture releases by major studios in the United States from 1934 to 1968. So really, this movie was the beginning of the end of the Hays Code. You know, from Some Like It Hot to then, I think Psycho was another one. The shower scene in Psycho was the very first time we saw a toilet on screen. This movie was even condemned by the Catholic Church for promoting homosexuality. Homosexuality, cross-dressing, the aforementioned impotence, bisexualism as well, transvestitism. So this movie really, really was progressive for that time period, you know, for 1959. It ended up being the third highest grossing movie of 1959, third only to The Shaggy Dog and Ben-Hur. So third highest grossing movie of 1959, it really destroyed those tropes of like the dumb blonde and like the white goddess, you know, the dumb blonde who's pretty much just there as like I said, the sex symbol, the, you know, who's just kind of there for eye candy. I mean, literally with the name Sugar, like it's pretty much saying that she's just there for eye candy. You know, the dumb blonde who's not very bright, the white goddess who screams, you know, sexual attention, yet she's, you know, yet she's most likely a virgin. And so, yeah, the dumb blonde, the white goddess. The movie is very progressive, both then and now. You know, look at all the progress that's been made. You know, now, like, there was, like, the movie with Robin Williams. I can't think of the name of. The movie was even referenced. Tony Curtis, he did a movie, I think, in 1962 called Sex and the Single Woman, where he actually references Some Like It Hot. Where Some Like It Hot is actually referenced in Sex and the Single Woman. So, yeah, this movie was just all around very, very progressive. You know, paved the way for the full abolition of the Hays Code just 9 years later, 1968. You know, defying expectations and understanding things from someone else's point of view. Now, I know there's the iconic line from, I read the book in high school and I've seen the movie To Kill a Mockingbird, probably one of my favorite books and, you know, a good movie as well. There's a line where Atticus Finch says how you can never truly understand someone else's point of view until you, like, step into their shoes and, or, like, step into their skin and crawl around a bit or, like, walk a mile in their shoes. So, I think that's a theme that comes up again and again in, like, in literature and in film as well. But I think this movie kind of puts its own little, like, I guess, gender satire on that, understanding things from someone else's point of view and unlearning and sort of like unlearning the male gaze, you know, like sure, the male gaze is a part of this movie, but it's not just a straight, it's not just like a straight male gaze, you know, there's other like bits of like nuance as well in this film. And of course, even the character of Sugar, she falls into that same, like, that stereotype that I would, must I hate to say, kind of exists today, that women only want men for their money, you know, and Joe plays into this, you know, Joe plays into it by disguising himself as Junior, you know, disguising himself as a millionaire. So then Sugar ends up going for him, but then the two of them actually end up falling in love, and so it kind of turns that on its head. And, you know, everything from its challenging of the male gaze to challenging the Hays Code to actually preaching tolerance and inclusion, you know, tolerance and inclusion, and really, you know, for myself as a Christian, you know, this actually becomes a very, you know, touchy subject for us, you know, especially myself as a follower of Christ, as a Christian, as someone who is currently teaching at a Catholic Jesuit high school. You know, you get to discussions of like homosexuality and tolerance and inclusion. You know, those are very, you know, touchy and controversial subjects. Let's not forget this movie was condemned by the Catholic Church back in 1959. You know, religion aside, I mean, this movie is just so iconic. And it's like I said, third highest grossing film of 1959. This movie definitely earned its spot in like the top 25 on the AFI top 100. I think it's number 20 something. Yeah, it's like number 20 something. I think it's, might be number 22. Might be like right after Chinatown. But yeah, you know, this movie, it really just did a lot for Hollywood at that time. It's number 22. It's number 22 on the AFI top 100. If I'm not mistaken, like, it's a Broadway musical now. Some Like It Hot. Like, it's been made into a Broadway musical, and it's just so iconic that we're still watching it to this day. Like, even though most movies were filmed in color at that time, and Marilyn Monroe even had a contract with the studio for the movie, for all of her movies to be for her to be filmed in color. Like, you watch any other movie that Marilyn Monroe's done, the majority of them, if not all of them, except for, you know, with the exception of Some Like It Hot, she was filmed in color. But then the director, Billy Wilder, he wanted the movie to be filmed in black and white because he just felt that the makeup that Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis were wearing was, you know, had like a green tint, and it just wouldn't look right in color. So he decided to do black and white instead. And I think the movie was better because of it. I think the black and white didn't really do any harm to Marilyn Monroe's looks. It didn't do any harm to, you know, Jack Lemmon or Tony Curtis's characters and their, you know, them being in full hair and makeup. And then if anything, actually the black and white is sort of a nod to the sort of the black and white way of looking at sort of like gender and sexuality, the male and female, you know, black and white. So yeah, it was a nice like artistic choice for Billy Wilder to do the black and white instead of color. I think the movie was better because of it. Yeah, this is just overall a great movie. Like It Hot, the movie, like I said, it was the third highest grossing film of 1959, and it only won one Oscar, but it had a total of 11 award wins and 13 nominations total, just of all the awards. But for the 1960 Academy Awards, Jack Lemmon was nominated for Best Actor in a Leading Role, Billy Wilder was nominated for Best Director. Both Billy Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond were nominated for Best Writing of a Screenplay based on material from another medium. Charles Lang was nominated for Best Cinematography. Again, black and white, like I said, you know, the black and white at a time when color was becoming the norm, when Technicolor was becoming the norm, so. And last but not least, Ted Haworth and Edward G. Boyle were nominated for Best Art Direction, Set Direction, black and white. So, I guess I'm missing one Oscar. That's nominated. Oh, and then Ori Kelly won the Oscar for Best Costume Design. Okay, so the movie had one Oscar win and 5 nominations. 5 nominations and 1 win for this movie. The trivia. Years after the film's release, a movie reviewer asked Tony Curtis why his Josephine was so much more feminine than Jack Lemmon's Daphne. Curtis explained he was so scared to be playing a woman or a man pretending to be one that his tightly wound body language could be read as demure and shy, traditionally feminine traits, whereas Lemmon, who was completely unbothered and ran out of his dressing room screaming like the Queen of the May, kept much more of his masculine body language. Okay, makes sense. I think also Tony Curtis, I feel like he also said that he based his character off of his mom, who was also very feminine, and so. Okay, yeah, Tony Curtis. Jack Lemmon wrote that the first sneak preview had a bad reaction with many audience walkouts. Many studio personnel and agents offered advice to Billy Wilder on what scenes to reshoot, add and cut. Lemmon asked Wilder what he was going to do. Wilder responded, "Why, nothing. This is a very funny movie, and I believe in it just as it is. Maybe this is the wrong neighborhood in which to have shown it. At any rate, I don't panic over one preview. It's a hell of a movie." Wilder held the next preview in the Westwood section of Los Angeles, and the audience stood up and cheered. Okay, yeah, sure. It's, but then also, like, the violence of the movie kind of, you know, like, the fact that, like, the, you know, St. Valentine's Day Massacre, then the humor becomes even, like, better later on in the film. Like, it sort of ups the stakes of the, film. And this was a departure for Billy Wilder, who had directed movies like, I think, like, The Lost Weekend, Sunset Boulevard, of course, and then I think he also did Double Indemnity. So he was used to, like, kind of like the noir films, you know, the dramas, and then this being a departure for Billy Wilder, doing now a comedy. So, and of course, there's going to be mixed reactions. Marilyn Monroe required 47 takes to get "It's me, sugar" correct, instead of saying either "sugar, it's me" or "it's sugar, me." After take 30, Billy Wilder had the line written on a blackboard. Another scene required Monroe to rummage through some drawers and say, "Where's the bourbon?" After 40 takes of her saying, "Where's the whiskey?" "Where's the bottle?" or "Where's the bonbon?" Wilder pasted the correct line in one of the drawers. After Monroe became confused about which drawer contained the line, Wilder had it pasted in every drawer. 59 takes were required for this scene, and when she finally does say it, she has her back to the camera, leading some to wonder if Wilder finally gave up and had it dubbed. Yeah, I mean, you know, these actors, you gotta know your lines, you gotta know your lines, and, you know, I think Hollywood, they do this all the time. They just cast people who are popular at that time, you know, people who are non-actors who are just popular, and then they end up doing these movies, but they can't act, and they just phone it in. So, Tony Curtis has said he asked Billy Wilder if he could imitate Cary Grant for his stint as the millionaire in the movie. Wilder liked it, and they shot it that way. Apparently, Grant saw the parody of himself and stated jokingly, "I don't talk like that." "I don't talk like that." It's hilarious. Hilarious. Cary Grant. I have to look up who this Cary Grant person is. But, yeah, it's almost like, if you go back and listen to my Citizen Kane episode, I talk about how, Citizen Kane, how the character was based off of a real life person who then found out about it and then, like, almost tried to have the movie not be made. And so, kind of one of those things. When Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon first put on the female makeup and costumes, they walked around the Goldwyn Studios lot to see if they could pass as women. Then they tried using mirrors in public ladies' rooms to fix their makeup, and when none of the women using it complained, they knew they could be convincing as women. There's a scene on the train recreating this moment. Okay. Well, you know, props to Tony Curtis and, you know, Jack Lemmon. You know, that's a bit of method acting, you know, big ups to, both of them. I can't wait to have Jamie Lee Curtis on the podcast, and yeah, you know, yeah, you know, method acting. That's commitment. That is commitment. All right. We got a user review. In this brilliant comedy, Marilyn was breathtakingly beautiful. 8 out of 10 stars. Any camera loved Marilyn the best. In all her films, Marilyn dominated any photographer, not just because of her ability with a script, but ceaseless attention to the camera. More than anyone else on the set, she knew the importance of her sex appeal. The 50s belonged to Marilyn, and in that decade, it almost seemed as if the world belonged to her also. Sugar is one of Monroe's most loved and memorable characters. She presents herself as a sensitive woman, quick to feel compassion or affection, sensual and readily impressionable, which is Sugar Cane. It was her guest role and certainly her greatest. It was her greatest role and certainly her greatest film. The film opens in 1929 Chicago during Prohibition, where Spats Colombo, played by George Raft, and his gang gun down 7 men in a car garage. A couple of small-time jazz musicians witness it and flee. To avoid the mob, Joe, played by Tony Curtis, and Jerry, played by Jack Lemmon, disguise themselves as women and attach themselves to an all-girl band. Joe calls himself Josephine, and Jerry calls herself Daphne. The orchestra takes a train to play an engagement in Florida. On board, the two men have a hard time keeping cool with all the beautiful girls around, especially during a late-night pajama party in a Pullman sleeper. Needless to say, Joe falls in love with the sensuous Sugar, played by Marilyn Monroe, a luscious ukulele player and singer with the troupe. Once in Florida, Jerry meets a really wealthy bachelor, Osgood Fielding, played by Joey Brown. Of course, Jerry is still dressed as Daphne, and the seven-time divorcee, proceeds to pursue Daphne. Joe wants to romance Sugar, but knows that he needs a wealthy front. The boys think they are safe until the gangsters arrive at the same Miami hotel to attend a gangsters convention. Marilyn sang three songs in the film: I'm Through With Love, I Want to Be Loved by You, and Running Wild. The movie's closing line is one of the most celebrated in movie history. The film won an Oscar for Best Costume Design and was nominated for 6 Academy Awards. Irresistibly funny, this black and white shot comedy is a definite must-see. This review is provided to us via Nazi Fighter Dave on June 27th, 2007 on IMDb. Big shout out to IMDb. Big shout out to Nazi Fighter David. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. 8 out of 10 stars. Okay, yeah, I agree 100%. You know, we will hopefully review more of Marilyn Monroe's movies on this podcast in the future, and as well as Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis on this platform. Yeah, the costume design, phenomenal. Just overall, a great movie. You know, it's an overall great movie. 8 out of 10 stars. It's got an IMDb rating of 8.2 out of 10 stars and a Letterboxd score of 4.2 out of 5. So, IMDb and Letterboxd agree in this case. The movie was released on March 19th, 1959, here in the United States. It is, you know, an American movie. It's in English. The movie is also known as Not Tonight, Josephine. The movie was... One of the main filming locations was the Hotel del Coronado at 1500 Orange Avenue, Coronado, California. This is the Seminole Ritz Hotel. The production companies were Ashton Productions and Mirisch, and the Mirisch Corporation. Box office. The movie had an estimated budget of $2.8 million, which is about $30.5 million in 2024. Its gross worldwide was only $195,000, which is about $2.1 million in today's money. So the movie did not make a profit at the box office at all. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a tomato meter score of 95% with an audience score of 94%. I'm kind of with the critics on this one, 95%. Critics' consensus: some like it hot, a spry, quick-witted farce that never drags. Where can you watch Some Like It Hot? Watch Some Like It Hot with a subscription on Max. You can also either rent or buy the movie on Vudu, Amazon Prime, or Apple TV. So that's all for this episode's review of Some Like It Hot. If you liked what you heard today, then don't forget to like this video, comment, share it, click that subscribe button, and turn on those post notifications so you get notified when I upload new episodes. If you want to stay up to date on all things Cobb's Corner, then all you need to do is follow me on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok. All of that information is in the description box below. For those of you that made it to the end of this episode, I greatly appreciate it. Click the video on the screen right now to listen to my last episode where I reviewed Chinatown. It is a complete banger of an episode. And as always, I'll talk to all of you in the next episode. Peace.
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys. it sound right, boys.